Welcome, everyone. This is The LaRue Show. It's Saturday, February 23rd, 2008. And on our weekly show this week, we are focusing on the topic of organizing to defeat the transatlantic fascist coup attempts underway, very live, in Europe, around what's called the Lisbon Treaty for our European superstate, and in the United States, around this Mussolini-Benito Bloomberg option that for the presidency. My name is Marcia Mary Baker. I'm with the Economics Division of the Executive Intelligence Review. I will moderate today, and I'm very glad to welcome into this discussion two people from Europe. But first, here in the studio with me live from the LaRouche Youth Movement War Room, welcome to Nick Walsh. Thank you.
Hi.
And speaking to us from Berlin, in the from the LaRouche Youth Movement office there in Germany, we welcome Daniel Buchmann. Welcome, Dan.
Hello.
And from speaking to us from Copenhagen, we have Tom Gillesberg, who is the director of the Schiller Institute in Denmark. Welcome, Tom.
Hello. Hi.
And in a second or two, a few seconds, we're going to begin with Tom. He's participated in an international conference that took place in Munich around the development perspective of maglev for the 21st century and development corridors for Eurasia and for the world. But before I do that, there is breaking news of something extremely strategically important. That is, the LaRouche Political Action Committee is going to host on March 12th an international internet conference by Lyndon LaRouche, and the title of that's going to be Averting Doom. That gives you an idea of the stakes right now in what we're talking about. It's not just words. People don't like to hear the F word because of their downgrading of their cultural outlook, namely the danger of fascism. But Lyndon LaRouche is going to speak on to this matter, Averting Doom, March 12th. That, I think, will be 1 p.m. Eastern Time in the United States, and I believe that will be centered in Washington, D.C. And you can find out more about that on the website of LaRouche's Political Action Committee, which is www.larouchepac.com. So, now, let's begin right away from Europe. And Tom, this conference I mentioned where you spoke, you participated in, you've been active for years, based in Copenhagen, would you begin by discussing what went on there?
Well, basically it was a conference arranged in Munich by the Schiller Institute and by the LaRouche campaign's German political organization, Bürgerrechtsbewegung Solidarität, BÜSO. And it took place in order to help strengthen the fight for actually getting a maglev train built in Munich from Munich Central Station to the airport, Franz Josef Strauss Airport, 37 kilometers away. And this has for some time been a very big fight in Munich, because those that have been following maglev technology knows that the most superior of them in function today is actually German. It's called Transrapid. And that's, among other things, the train that is traveling every day, every 15 minutes from Shanghai to Shanghai Airport and the other way, and functions very well. And for a long time, there's been a big internal fight in Germany about whether or not to get this built in Germany. And there actually was reached an agreement that this was going to be built, the first German part of such a system, from Frankfurt to Munich to Munich Airport. This is a big local fight. Unfortunately, it's the case that the local Social Democratic Party, for local reasons, is trying to make it a big campaign against it, saying this is too advanced technology, it goes too fast, we don't really need this, couldn't we just things stay like they are today? Really lousy arguments, and this would and trying to mobilize against it. So for this reason, we had a conference mobilizing for it. We also had a lot of our youth group, LaRouche Youth Movement members, in Munich to go out on the streets to mobilize people and basically make sure that people understand that this is not just something locally to get out to Munich Airport. It's very important to get it built in order to start the whole process of building such a maglev system or in Germany, in Europe, but actually also over time is such a system that could be connected all the way over Eurasia, through Russia, all the way over to China, all the way over New Bering Strait, a tunnel to America. And this bigger perspective was totally not there in the local debate, and therefore also we had this conference to bring it in and basically pick the fight why it's so extremely important that Germany gets out of this whole green ideology and gets back to the fantastic tradition of science, of new technology, of contributing these beautiful technologies not only to the rest of the world, but also to implement them in Germany.
And you had some technical participation, I guess, but otherwise this was a big, wide-open perspective you were presenting. That's the idea.
Yeah, and I was also from up here, of course, basically presenting the fight that we have been leading in Denmark to get the maglev technology implemented, but also to remind people that the biggest argument against building a maglev net in Denmark going 500 kilometers an hour, more than 300 miles per hour. The biggest argument against it is all the time that people say, well, if this technology is so great, why don't the Germans use it themselves? And therefore, if we build it in Germany, then that opens the door. Then everybody can have it. Now, what happened at the conference was that this was the theme. But then there was an extraordinary thing, namely that Lyndon LaRouche actually came together with Helge Sepp LaRouche to participate in the conference and speak. And Lyndon and Helge used this opportunity to broaden the theme by basically laying out that the framework of this fight is not only a question of maglev technology or this or that. Right now, we are standing in the midst of a big fight whether or not global fascism will take over the United States in the person of Michael Bloomberg as a coming president of the United States. And parallel to that right now there's a drive to have Europe, have the European Union adopt a Lisbon Treaty, which basically would take away much of the rest of what's left of national sovereignty for the European nations. And this is a process that has been going on for a long time, as most people don't reflect about it. But this whole idea of globalization, of outsourcing, of moving away economic productions, for instance, out of the United States, but also out of Europe to China to other places, is not only a way for some people to earn some money on looting labor force in other countries, but it's actually also a process of doing away with national sovereignty. And this has been going on in Europe now for some time. Those that's been following it, and LaRouche laid it out at the conference actually, that in response to the fall of the Berlin Wall and to the dissolution of the Soviet Union, and the opportunity of really getting Europe to grow and to blossom, then was put forward immediately this whole idea of a new common currency called the euro and a Maastricht Treaty which would tie in Germany and other countries in such a way that they could not really develop and that they could not use their full economic potential and build up Eastern Europe and build up the world. And the latest part of that process is that this Lisbon Treaty has been put forward. Actually, there was a meeting in the end of last year where the prime ministers of the 27 nations actually signed on to the treaty. And now we are in the process where, over the coming months, all of the different nations has to ratify this treaty. And if they do so, well, then the road is paved, basically, for having taking away a lot of the the protections of the nation states, and basically paved for having what you can say basically a model of global fascism. And I think that Daniel has actually been looking into also and presenting down in Germany, where we are right now making this into a big discussion, getting people involved in this discussion of why this European treaty is actually so nasty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's actually the number one item of the organizing of the LaRouche youth movement in Germany, and also of our political party here. Basically, the Lisbon Treaty, what it contains is like 90 or 95% of the EU constitution or European constitution that was defeated back in 2005 by referenda in the Netherlands and in France, and actually also the German Constitutional Court then forbade the German president to sign onto it, because the Bundestag and Bundesrat, that's the two houses of parliament in Germany, voted for the European Constitution, but the Constitutional Court said, no, you can't sign it, forbade the president to sign it. And people now have forgotten it. Many people don't even know that the German Constitutional Court made that decision back then. And then they basically took the whole package, gave it a new name, had a meeting, had a conference December 13th in Lisbon. The 27 governments signed it. And actually, since then, there hasn't been much coverage of any European issues in the media in any European country whatsoever. They basically want to push this through and keep silence and no controversy over the question of Europe whatsoever.
And Daniel, let me get this straight too. If you bring out some of the content of this, this includes the right for the overall European Union superstate to tax, to make other laws, to even to reimpose the death penalty, which individual nation states in Europe eliminated, right? What's the content?
Sure. That's part of the German basic law that was formed in 1949. The death penalty does not exist anymore in Germany. And there's actually a paragraph or an article in the EU Constitution that says the exact same thing. But then there's a commentary of it or an explanation which says, in situations of civil upheaval or of war, the death penalty can be reintroduced. And of course, we are at war. We have German soldiers, for example, in Afghanistan. We have military interventions in Africa, in Congo, in Chad, for example. Take the case of civil upheaval, and take the case of Eastern Germany in 1989, where people started to demonstrate against the government. In these situations, the death penalty could be reintroduced, and it basically means that some fundamental human rights stop to exist. And that's just one aspect of it, and I think one of the aspects that was relevant for the decision of the Constitutional Court back in 2005. But what it means overall is that constitutional power goes from the nation state to the European Council that is in Brussels. That is, the lawmaking power goes to the bureaucracy in Brussels. And actually, I attended a caucus meeting on the European Union at the German Parliament on Wednesday, and there was total confusion in that hearing among the experts on what are the powers of the EU Commission and what are the powers of the EU Council. And basically, you have a bureaucracy in Brussels. Nobody knows exactly what they're doing, but there's no parliamentary oversight. People don't vote for this bureaucracy, and it's just a complete confusion that works in favor of the financial oligarchy that, of course, wants to find a way to maintain their power in this moment of financial crisis.
Right, and on that latter point, the content of what is in this Lisbon Treaty from December, you mentioned human rights and so forth, but on the economy, then it would be anything goes for this Brussels apparatus to dictate, and namely austerity and worse, that kind of thing.
Yeah, of course. The European Union would take over the whole internal market of Europe, and for the purpose of competition, the lowest standard would apply for all of Europe. Let's say you have a certain standard for production or for security or for environmental protection in, let's say, Greece. The producer in Germany would say, I want that same lower standard for my production here in Germany, and it would mean in terms of wages, in terms of everything, the lowest standard would come into existence. And the same thing goes for foreign trade, where the EU sets tariffs and everything, and there's no control over economic policy from the national governments anymore. And also a question of currency policy. We already have a European currency union, the euro, and the euro means the governments have no means for a productive credit generation, which was absolutely essential for both Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal in the 1930s, 40s, but also for post-war reconstruction in the 50s and 60s in Germany. And these means of essential economic policy of sovereign governments is being taken away.
I think also, actually, you have really to see this perspective that right now there's a big rush to get this through now. You cannot wait. You cannot ask the populations. They are not ready. Then you have to stuff it down their throats. Because what they're afraid of in Europe right now, as well as in the United States, from the financial oligarchy, is that in this present economic crisis, where it's totally evident that the economic policy has failed, that all of the textbooks has to be thrown out, and you have to try to something different, there's this fear that maybe people will use the Franklin D. Roosevelt model. Mm-hmm. That maybe the nations will say, gee, it didn't work. Globalization has failed. Yeah. Let's do like Franklin D. Roosevelt and the United States did in the 30s. The state go in with big projects, we go in and build it. And what you do with the Maastricht Treaty before and with this new Lisbon Treaty is to try to prevent that opportunity from happening.
Yeah, and just to highlight one of the other aspects of it is there's going to be an EU president and a so-called high representative. It's actually not clear what power do either of them have, but they would determine the foreign policy of the European Union and would go also for total militarization of the European Union. Basically, the European Union and NATO would somehow merge to be one and would become some kind of imperial structure or new European empire in which the general welfare of the people is completely thrown out of the window. I mean, you mustn't forget that in Germany we also have very high unemployment, and also in most European countries we have a full economic crisis, and there's not going to be a solution to the crisis. They're going to push for massive austerity, push for privatization of public services like mail, like transportation, electricity, and other such things.
So, and if you want to bring out one aspect of this, there's that throws it into strong relief, the idea of having someone like Tony Blair become the leader of this, who spoke about this, I think, a few years ago. I know he visited Chicago, I remember at the time, saying we're going into a new era where the nation states are old-fashioned. And he's the one who, of course, initiated the Iraq War and so forth. But this is part of the push that's in such a rush. You're getting that kind of proposal?
Yeah, absolutely. And if, let's say, he, as a EU president, were to decide over sanctions to, let's say, Iran, and he also wanted to push for a war against Iran together with people like Dick Cheney. The governments, the national governments, could not resist it. There's a so-called solidarity clause built into the EU treaty, which means that if you have a war, basically everybody has to be in solidarity and fight together. And if somebody like Tony Blair then provokes a war with Iran, there's no way out of it. And also what the treaty demands from the government, the national government, is military buildup increasing defense budget and other such things.
And I think also it's relevant that normally in most democracies, people don't really intervene so much in policy, except when you have a leader that's really going against the general welfare and doing insane things like going into war. And then the population normally would have a chance to overthrow that government some way or another. Mm-hmm. But the way the whole idea with the Lisbon Treaty is basically that you put up a bureaucratic government that is above all the nations, and where there is no representative democracy in this sense. People cannot intervene against it. Mm-hmm. They're basically like subjects of an empire, where the local stuff you can decide yourself, but it's all based on the imperial rulings coming out from the emperor, the Emperor Blair, or whoever, and you can't really change anything. And this is, I think it's very relevant, because this is exactly against these types of ideas that the United States was founded. Exactly to say, no, this cannot be true. We have a right as a people to be sovereign, to decide our own destiny. And therefore, I also think that the full danger of this European operation can only be seen from the aspect of what will happen if fascism comes in the United States. If the oligarchy is successful in actually overthrow the normal electoral process that is being done right now, undermine it, and then come in with Michael Bloomberg and a fascist model in the United States, and then there will be nothing in Europe to defend anything, then Europe will just follow in on the fascist policies.
Well, let's go back and forth on this. Maybe this is where, Nick, you want to give an update even on some of the response of the population when the LaRouche Youth Movement is out there meeting people head on, whether it's at an Obama rally like Ohio or whether it's in Texas in the institution like the state capitol in Austin. And because, by the way, I'll just throw in there for everyone, the governors of the country are meeting in Washington right now on a pre-scheduled meeting. And tomorrow it looks like that this, the Felix Rohat and the kind of fascist option push in the United States through the presidential campaign period will have some official announcement in the form of this facade called Build America's Future. A press conference in the afternoon at the National Governors Association will be focused on this by Arnold Schwarzenegger himself, I think, and the governor of Pennsylvania, and Rendell, who's going along, and some others. But Nick, what do you want to bring out here?
Well, it's the same thing that our friends in Europe have been discussing so far. Being done to the United States, it's the same policy circles. And I think it's important to note two most broad things. One is that fascism is very possible in the United States. Although we've never had fascism here in the entire history of our country, it is possible to have it now. And the fascists like Felix Rohatyn and George Shultz, who are backing the Michael Bloomberg option, they intend to make fascism a reality in this country. And they're pulling out all the stops because, as was mentioned, the financial system of the world presently in its present form, the dollar-based system, is finished. It can't be recovered under its present state. And there's either going to be a increasing brutalization of the population in order for the Felix Rohatyn-style circles to maintain power, or we're going to have a totally different system like Franklin Delano Roosevelt instituted in our country in the 30s and 40s. So that, and that's, those are the two options. Now, in that sense, in the same sense, fascism can be defeated. And that's what we're doing in two states are good places to look right now to focus in on how we're destroying the fascist option of Bloomberg. It's in Ohio and Texas. And there's two primaries coming up on March 4th where the traditional candidates that most Americans believe are the ones you have to choose between are all on the ballot. But we're campaigning to defeat Bloomberg in the Ohio and Texas primaries. There's also primaries in Rhode Island and Vermont, which are significant, and we're also deploying there. But the focus is Texas and Ohio, which are the make-or-break states right now for the entire presidential campaign. It's going to decide a lot. So just as one example, as people probably know from watching the news, there's an incredible euphoria built up around the Obama campaign, which is this false euphoria, because Obama is already targeted to be destroyed by the same people that are backing Bloomberg to come in. So they're propping him up with one hand, and they're getting ready to smack him down with the other. And this is centralized in London. But Obama, his personality and his campaign is played right into the game. And the youth that are coming out to these election events are being whipped up into a frenzy, like a Dionysian orgy festival going on in these events, where there's very little substance actually emphasized in the discussion, but a lot of hooting, a lot of hollering, a lot of screaming, and there's a real manipulation going on of people at these things. Now, what we did is we went to one of these events at Cleveland State University, and the Obama people were saying, well, go out and vote right away after coming out of this euphoric state where you have the rock music and the stuff. And we were standing outside, not attacking any of the candidates, but we had a big banner that said, defeat Bloomberg in the Ohio primary. And it had a nice button with a mock Bloomberg campaign button on it. And people were coming out and they were doing a double take at the banner because they were saying, Bloomberg? Who's Bloomberg? He's not running. We're for Obama. We're running against Clinton. Who's Bloomberg? And we were able to actually snap a lot of people directly by talking to them. But generally, the environment out of its state. We have the leaflet called Mitt Romney Walks Out, written by Lyndon LaRouche, which we're getting just the first 250,000 out now. We're going to get a lot more. And we have the essential pamphlet is The Devil in Your Laptop, which addresses this crazy cyberspace fascist culture online that young people spend many hours a day in. And this literature, with the banner and the discussion, is the kind of thing that we're doing in the two states right now.
Right. You may have questions or want to bring out things from Europe, but one thing, Daniel, you said organizing against this fascist takeover attempt in Europe, the Lisbon Treaty form of it, you've made this the number one organizing on the streets of Berlin and elsewhere. Do you want to throw in something there about how you snap people into facing reality?
Yes, sure. We have a leaflet written by Helga, which is called Financial Oligarchy is Planning Global Fascism. Is Germany threatened by a second Versailles, which of course was the peace treaty after World War I, which basically destroyed Germany economically and paved the way to fascism and World War II. But what we do is we tell people in the streets what this Lisbon Treaty means and tell them about some of the powers that they actually have as people. For instance, we have the German basic law, after all, it's not so bad. And in Article 20, Paragraph 2, it says that all governmental power comes from the people and that it's expressed by the people in votes and referenda. And, of course, we have votes every couple of years, but the question of referenda has never been really formulated because, I don't know, maybe they weren't interested in it, but we make the point. We have a right in Germany for this very, very important referendum and collect signatures on it, and also other organizations have started to do just that. And the other thing that we point out is Article 146 of the Basic Law, the Grundgesetz, because the Grundgesetz was written in 1948-49 for Western Germany, and there's a paragraph that says that after the German reunification and once all German people are unified and free, then a new constitution shall be formed that must be decided by the whole German people in freedom of choice, basically. And since the Lisbon Treaty basically means a new constitution, and the German Basic Law says, okay, in that case, the people must decide, we fight for it. And now what the government and the media and the oligarchy is doing, they try to keep it as silent as possible. No news coverage of it at all. And so we tell people what's going on. And I just realized last week when we started to organize around that subject, people reacted quite immensely, much, much stronger than usual. The second Versailles, old people stop dead in their tracks. They see the picket and they stop. We have pickets saying German government supports Blair dictatorship, or EU reform treaty means fascism in Europe, or pickets like that. And people stop. Hey, what are you guys doing? What's going on? Is there anything that I missed? And people come into discussions. People sign up. People get the leaflets. People want to know what this is all about. And that's what we do in Germany. And of course, there's resistance to it in other European countries as well. For example, in Austria, there's great resistance because the Austrian constitutional law makes Austria a neutral state. Austria did not want to be grinded between the NATO and Warsaw Pact in the post-World War II era, and so they have a neutrality clause in their constitution. And, of course, neutrality would go out of the window if we have this Lisbon Treaty quasi-European constitution. And they make a constitutional issue over on this question in Austria. And there's also resistance in other countries.
So you would say, based on Tom stressing the pace of all this, there is a frenzy by the enemy of mankind to push it through, that you think there's a pickup in different countries of the resistance could really grow very fast based on your sense of the pickup in the organizing.
Yes, yes. I think there's a referendum in Ireland in May. There's a great debate in Finland where about 69% of the people, according to some polls, are against the treaty because the EU, the internal market of Europe, made possible that cheap labor came from Eastern Europe into Finland, and the unions there in Scandinavia fight against it. There's other countries, I think it was Slovakia, where the government does not have the majority in the parliament for it, and what it means is if it stopped in one country, it may be stopped for all of Europe, because it's supposed to be a treaty for all of Europe, and if it stopped in one country, it may go out of the window for all of Europe.
Right, thanks. Well, back to the United States, Nick. You mentioned about Ohio, but Texas, when this term, this conceptualization of how to have an impact called the mass effect, that in Texas we have a tremendous effort, right, to saturate areas, I guess you could call it, in Austin, the capital, based on the universities. We've had forays into San Antonio. What do you think of the pace of the response there?
Well, that's what we're focusing on, is the mass effect. And as in Europe, as in the United States, it's the only way to defeat the oligarchy. We're focusing in Texas on three cities, Houston, Austin, and San Antonio. And for all that are familiar with Texas, it's as big as a lot of countries in the world, or bigger. It's enormous. And so we're not going to run around with, 10, 12 organizers and try to, get one leaflet into every city of Texas. What you do is we're focusing in on these three key areas where a lot of the political activity is, where a lot of the biggest universities are, and where some of the campaign events are going to be. We decided partway into this that we were going to create a sound truck. So we rigged up our pickup truck with a huge wooden frame with a big banner on it saying Defeat Fascist Bloomberg, March 4th. We're driving around with the bullhorn hooked up to it. And then, so we're driving around, let's say, a campus announcing on the megaphone to people what they need to do, handing out leaflets, and then you have organizers on the ground with tables set up and different things on the street corners saying, hello, you get what they're doing, this is more on it, stop here, leave your name and number. Now, after a number of days in Austin, Texas, for example, we found that the population generally knew who Michael Bloomberg was. And they knew that this guy was intending to run for president and that this option was live. The first day, you get all this, Bloomberg? 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 Which is what people kept saying. Now people are coming up and saying, LaRouche is right. I followed LaRouche for 20 years. You guys did this in the 80s. LaRouche, didn't he do that in the 90s? One man was overjoyed to find that LaRouche was out of prison. He apparently has not been keeping up with things.
Rip Van Winkle under a rock.
But you have a general response now through the population where we have gone in with this mass effect, which is the principle of changing the environment of the place that you're organizing in, changing the actual way that everyone is thinking. Because the media here in the U.S. and in the very same way in Europe with the Lisbon Treaty are trying to pull this thing right under the noses of the population before they can even think about it. So they're getting people here riled up about Obama. The media's orchestrating huge attacks against Clinton. And then you've got this guy McCain who they're going to bring down in one way or another. Same thing in Europe, where they have a treaty that's not going to be discussed. It was already rejected by the population, so they're going to ram it through behind closed doors. And the key is you get out with the literature and the music and the bullhorn rallies and the things, and you electrify the area around the real issue. And soon enough, you get these responses. And so, this, like I was saying earlier, this can be defeated. We have a lot of work yet to do that people that are listening have to join us in.
Right. I've seen some of the Daniel was mentioning the picket signs that get people to snap to attention in Berlin. In Ohio, I saw there was one called Bloomberg in 2008, ? Kill it in the shell. So obviously people have to know what it's... You get somebody's attention that way.
Yep.
And this mock-up of the Bloomberg campaign button that says on it, I've seen a picture of it circulating in Ohio, there's Bloomberg looking very official on the button, and it says, private government is better anyway.
Right, and on the top it says, Michael Benito Bloomberg, 08. And this is, and then we also have a bunch of these freaks in the United States, like Barney Frank, Nancy Pelosi, Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, Martin Peretz. You have kind of an endless gaggle of circus freaks, Ben Bernanke, who are all partisans of fascism, and what the Ted Kennedy, who we are going out and scandalizing these fools, and we're going to be ridiculing them a lot more in the near future. We have a banner in Boston that they made, which is the state, Massachusetts, where Barney Frank presides from the Congress. And we have it's a banner called Dingaling Brothers Barney and Bailout Circus. And it's right in the front is Barney Frank throwing cash in the air. You have Ben Bernanke with a helicopter beanie flying through the air throwing money. Bloomberg is on the left on a white horse about to ride in. Obama's in a Superman costume about to slip off of a tightrope. You have Nancy Pelosi in tights riding in on an elephant. But this is the circus of fascism. And we go out and we piss off the people who are sleeping in bed with these fascists, and then you also enlighten the population to what's trying to be pulled over their head, and you can change things.
Well, that's I love the scandalizing part. That's really what we got to have.
That's where all the fun is.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of this, is I'm not going to go further on this image, but speaking of why somebody gets in bed with these people, and I this is a question to you in Europe as well as Nick, but. You know,
catch some kind of funny something.
This one of the central lines here that's promoted, the way Nick was talking about the media and so forth, is that it's hopeless. There's no more revenue in city or county or state governments. The poor are just going to have to take a hit. That's Arnold Schwarzenegger's line. Everybody will take a hit, and so there's no other way to have government functions for the people, except for working with the private interests, as it's been called over the years, public-private partnerships or performance-based infrastructure or all of this kind of thing. And so some of the people going along with it are, I mean, things are happening very fast. One of the, you've had bankruptcies of school districts, one of the cities in California with, I think, 126,000 people. Vallejo, I think it might be, is really de facto bankrupt. I don't know what it's going to do. The LaRouche Youth Movement has been there with the council chambers to try and get them to face reality. So that side of things, the economic breakdown, the not just the fancy names, like mono lines, CDOs, not that kind of stuff, which is all true. It's all exploded. But the actual day-to-day functioning. Now, that's really feeding into things here. Do you want to say something? I'm going to talk about the United States, North America, and elsewhere. But in Europe, you have the situation there, I presume.
I would say, I mean, really one has to look back at the 30s. Because in Europe, there's always... in Europe, basically the tradition is that to do exactly what you just described. You say there's not enough money, well, then we have to cut down, then we have to do this, then we have to do this. What saved Europe last time was the fact that the United States did what no one in Europe could do, basically, which was to go against these financial interests. That you had a Roosevelt that, with the backing of the population, I mean, and I think it really has to... I mean, now you have all of these youth being mobilized politically right now around Barack Obama, right? For nothing. And then they're supposed to back Barack Obama, and then he's being basically flushed out the toilet, and then they'll all be demoralized and do nothing. And instead, they have to be mobilized to say, no, we want a Franklin D. Roosevelt. We have tried this before. We had this exactly the same conditions leading into Franklin D. Roosevelt. The economy was going down, the banks were going bankrupt, everything was in a mess. It was seemingly hopeless. We were bankrupt. But what Franklin D. Roosevelt was, that he did this thing that's uniquely American, was to say, we won't go out to ask for a loan. No, we as a government and as a people have the power to create credit ourselves. The U.S. government can simply create credit to build big infrastructure projects, to get the economy rolling again. And through these big infrastructure projects, get people employed in doing useful things, begin to rebuild the economy. And not only do that, but as those that study history knows, by Roosevelt doing that in the United States, he also developed the strength of the U.S. economy to basically to be able to pay for the rest of the world taking up the fight against the fascism that totally took over in Europe. Historically, this is people really have to appreciate this, and I think it's very important for all our American listeners to really reflect on this, especially the youth, that the United States has this totally unique historical role of doing this. If the United States has not done it under Franklin D. Roosevelt, we probably... the world would be a much poorer place today because we would have had a long time of fascism. Population would die out. The planet would have been a total mess. And right now, that impulse in the United States has to come into play again. That this is the time where you say, well, I'm an American. What does that mean? It means that at certain key historical times, like the one today, when the planet is in danger of being taken over by this terrible monster, where seemingly there's no hope, then we intervene politically as a potent political force with the LaRouche movement, with the LIM, and we actually, very few persons, can change the global policy by making sure that the right policies and the right ideas are there at this time. And really, Europe is dependent on that because... To be very frank, if the United States doesn't make it, if the United States goes fascist, then there's not much likelihood of Europe coming in to challenging it. then the European countries will basically be lining up to to be first among the fascists. That's the bad historical precedence. So we really have to make sure we do it again in the United States.
Go ahead, Daniel.
Yeah, I could maybe give a few examples to indicate the ideology of the financial oligarchy here. In previous years, like in banking institutions like Deutsche Bank would record record profits of, I don't know, so and so many billion euros, and then the same day they say, oh, we wanted to have 1 billion euro more profit, so we have to lay off so and so many thousands of workers. But then since July last year, we've had a full banking crisis globally, starting, of course, with the subprime market, and some of the financial paper blew out, and the Landesbanken in Germany, like Sachsen-LB, West-LB, the EKB, which is a Mittelstand bank, Industriekreditbank, these banks basically went bankrupt. And what the government did is the government of Germany, together with some other banking institutions in Germany, made a bailout package for those banks, specifically Sachsen-LB and EKB, where these so-called risks in financial paper, which are really losses, unpayable, are supposed to be paid by the taxpayer. So profit is private, but the losses are being are supposed to be paid by the people lowering living standards. It means higher taxes. It means less money is available for communities, and that's just the tip of the iceberg of the financial bubble that we are talking about here. They are just talking about a few billion of euros, while at the same time we're sitting on a debt bubble of, I don't know, trillions, quadrillions, that is many, many times higher than the product of the whole world economy, that are never going to be paid. And that's why the oligarchy is pushing for this Mussolini corporativism globally. It's pushing for it in Europe, it's pushing for it in the United States. The central banks in 2007 started to print money massively. We see it with rising inflation. You go to the supermarket and the price of milk, the price of other food stocks is much, much higher than a year ago, like 50% higher in many cases. And, of course, in a country like Germany, it hurts many people. Many people have just as much money as they need to survive. Really, of course, some people are rich, but many people, like pensioners, like students, workers, just have enough money to live. And it hurts people in Germany, but look at how much more it hurts people in other countries in the world, like Africa, South America, Asia, where people don't have enough to live in, and people start to starve because some speculators at the world stock markets are speculating on food prices and other such things. So this is really fascism right there. The people are supposed to pay for the collapsing financial bubble.
And one could just think also, these enormous sums of money being pumped in right now to sustain these bankrupt banks. Sure, you have to save the banks, but you don't have to save all of the gambling debts that most of the banks have. You could go in, you can take the bank, and you basically write off the gambling debt, and you keep the bank for normal things. But instead, you spend the money on getting on with these big projects, like building maglev systems. I mean, you look at the United States, there's no public infrastructure, which of course is very bad, but it also means that if you take a brand new technology like the maglev technology, you could basically sit down on the drawing board and map out where should the rail lines be in the United States. So you can travel between all the major cities with 300 miles per hour with a maglev, traveling, flying along the ground, basically, and where you don't have to go to some kind of stupid airport in order to go somewhere and wait for hours and hours, but where you step into the train, you travel 300 miles per hour, you get to your destinations, you get out, and you do what you have to do. And all of these things has to be built. I mean, you look at the world right now. I mean, if we begin to reshape, bring the U.S. economy back and begin to employ people actually producing something again, and the same thing in Europe, well, then we actually have the perspective of being able to rebuild this planet. That you no longer have to go around feeling sorry for the fact that South America is dying or 80% of the population of China and India is living in utter poverty, or that Africa is going simply disappearing as a living continent. We could actually globally begin to, as part of basically saying we let the financial system as it has, we have known it, we have to let it go. We build a new Bretton Woods system along the plans that Frank, along the ideas that Franklin D. Roosevelt laid out before. We rebuild the system, and then we have this kind of global collaborations on rebuilding the planet.
Yeah,
and this is really, I mean, why? I mean, this is a tremendous time to be alive. I mean, some people would say, oh, how terrible it is. I wish I would have lived in the good times. Now I'm living in terrible times, threat of fascism. It's terrible. But in reality, it's really a great gift because we are living at a time where the biggest historical battle in the modern times of mankind is basically being fought out. And we have the opportunity to intervene and actually be a decisive factor in deciding how this goes. And that's a hell of a lot more fun than hanging around on MySpace or Facebook and thinking about how I'm going to commit suicide or how I'm going, who am I going to shoot tomorrow? All of these insane things are playing crazy computer games.
Right. Well, Nick may want to say more about that in the kind of full-scale organizing in many parts of the United States, especially on campuses among youth and so forth, to cut through the virtual reality that's so deadly.
Well, it's the same. It's the Bloomberg. It's the Bloomberg campaign is based on the MySpace, Facebook, and computer game mentality. It's the mentality of existentialism, of alienation, of suicide, homicide, rage, and just disassociation from reality. And the digital programs of these computer systems have been organized in order to decorticate the person using them from a sense of their cognitive capability. And it's a very deliberate programming. And the programming is designed in, for example, in the way that the language on the most internet pages is used. You find that the young person who's increasingly on these pages has a brutally degenerate sense of language. I mean, worse than a peasant of Europe of the 1400s. It's
fewer than 500 words.
It's extremely bad. It's words with no vowels. It's this form of small speak that's kind of invented by these young people, so-called, as they're on these things. But the program itself steers them more and more to use this monkey-style language because the programs emphasize nouns and they emphasize object fixation, where the only emphasis on language is communicating some immediate object that you might want. There's no ideas. And this is just a fact. I mean, anybody in the country right now who's defending MySpace, Facebook, or computer games is a fascist. They're lining up and they're joining the fascists. Because this is obvious that you look at the young kids on these games and they are in hysterically, you know, obsessive states of mind, completely unhealthy kinds of thinking. And what LaRouche, I think, to counterpoint on this, wrote recently is this paper on Monad. Because Lyndon LaRouche today is the living Franklin Roosevelt. In our United States, we have the opportunity to get out of this crisis because of LaRouche and his policies, his ideas. He wrote this paper on Leibniz's paper, The Monadology, which really goes through the real nature of man and goes back to the beginning of knowledge being that of astrogation, of seafaring cultures who were studying the stars and studying the paradoxes and the problems that would come up and trying to figure out the different cycles occurring in the sky and what the governing principles of some of these cycles were. And from this, there would be an immediate ability to navigate over the seas and map your location on the earth based on your knowledge of the heavens, based on your knowledge of the astronomical cycles. So this LaRouche is pointing out in this paper that this is really the beginning of human knowledge and human physical economy. And it's expressed in this idea of Leibniz's paper, The Monad. Now, that's today the alternative. If the United States is going to survive, as Tom was pointing out, is obviously so important, then it needs to be by the population, especially the youth, embracing the leadership of LaRouche and taking up the fact that this guy truly has been providing leadership to the United States and the world for over 35 years. If you want change, you have to actually think. You can't. The substance of change is human thinking. And it's clear that change is good, and the sentiment of people right now for change is not a bad thing. But it has to be raised to a totally transcendental level, beyond what people are thinking now. And that means people have to get off of MySpace and organize with the LaRouche Youth Movement to figure out these difficult ideas that LaRouche is challenging people with.
Hey, Nick?
Yeah.
Maybe you want to indicate some of the work that the guys are doing in the basement in this new video that they are producing.
Sure, why not? They just finished it. It's on the website. It's called Firewall in Defense of the Nation State. And it shows so clearly that 1923 Germany is the United States now. So you have 1923 Germany, hyperinflation, a externally imposed destruction of the German nation state carried out by the British Empire. That destruction of Germany, which led directly but to Hitler with intent, and to Mussolini in Italy, and to the fascism that swept Europe, which Tom was bringing up, was a British-motivated, British Empire-instilled policy. That's going on in the U.S. now. It's been the policy, as they go through in this movie, since the 68er counterculture, the post-FDR orchestration into the 68er counterculture. And people should watch it. And people should be alarmed. And people will be set into a panic, as they should be, by seeing this. Because, you see, if we do not change the course of our United States right now, we are going to be in 1923 hyperinflationary Germany, in that sense of an economy. And from that type of chaos, you can only get one thing, which is war and fascism. So the basement also, in this light, is working. The original mission was to work on an advancement of the Kepler project, which is on the Gauss. And they've figured out a lot, and they're putting together their final reports, which will be coming out sometime in the near future, probably by spring. This report that they've put together on Gauss, Carl Gauss's discoveries concerning the orbit of Ceres, which is a planetary orbit between Mars and Jupiter. No planet there, but it's an orbit. And his understanding of the trajectory of how this worked was based on the way that Kepler thought and the way that Nicholas of Cusa thought and the way that Leibniz thought. And you're right. I mean, that kind of work, this kind of thinking, has not been done in the United States for many decades. It's a real renaissance we have the capability to create, but young people have to stop wanting to be stupid. And 14 to 25-year-olds have to stop wanting to be dumb zombies with a pea-sized brain. And they want to have to think and get off the cyberspace, and the reality and the ideas that our movement is offering are tangible, and they're right there for people to begin working on.
Right. People may want to add quite a lot of things because we only have less than 3 minutes to go. But one thing here, it's been used around the world, the four-minute kind of preview video of the essence of the process of this hyperinflation, the Weimar period, 1923 to today. Do you want to say anything about that, Daniel, in Europe, or Nick can chime in about the impact confronting people to start to conceptualize again, how much it works or how much it doesn't? I mean, reaction is.
Of course, people in Germany are quite allergic to the word inflation. I mean, for example, I have 3,000 marks that some great grand uncles or parents or whatever saved to buy a house or build a house or something. And then in 1923, it just was completely worthless piece of paper. You know, your life savings, from which you could live when you were old, just went out of the window within a very, very short period of time. So this is something where people in Germany react to, quite massively actually. And people think 1923 is when the hyperinflation happened. But what people don't know is that there was a whole period from 1914 until 1923 that went into it. And it was just basically the collapse occurred in 1923, the total collapse. But you had the printing press went on in 1914 to finance the war. And, of course, it was they printed massive, massive amounts of money in the early 20s to finance these Versailles reparations, which you can learn about in detail in that video.
Well, Daniel, I'm afraid you've had the last word, and that does raise that you have to know history, and today we're making history. So I want to thank you all. That is Nick, Daniel, and Tom. We're closing out the show February 23rd, 2008. Be sure and listen March 1st. But March 12th is a new LaRouche Political Action Committee International webcast on Averting Doom by Lyndon LaRouche. And otherwise, everyone, look on and get this 80-minute movie, Firewall in Defense of the Nation State, on LaRouchePAC.com. Thank you, everyone, for today's discussion.